been explaining that historically one of the reasons why Reb Chaim Volozhiner started the Volozhiner Yeshiva was to counteract the impact of Haskalah in Russia and Lithuania in particular, because many of the most talented people were nimshach after the secularism and the educational opportunities that were opened up to Jews in mathematics and science and medicine and the like. And it was important, therefore, to save these people for Klal Yisrael, to open up a maisid where the best minds would come and be exposed to the most advanced learning. And therefore, I'll use secular analogies because they're easier for us to understand in some ways. And Mimela, Volozhin, was like the Harvard or the MIT of the time. It was not for Beinonim, it was for Mamish Mitsuyanim, and that was the whole concept. By the way, I remember I was... I once had the occasion. I had to be a witness or an expert witness on some American law in Bnei Brak, a basin of Bnei Brak. So it was very, very interesting that there were two lawyers in the case. One was from Harvard. One was from Yale. And the Dayanim didn't understand. Bus is Harvard. Bus is Yale. So one of the other Dayanim said, "You know, Mir and Panovich is oh, stay okay." So, anyway. So, but the truth of the matter is, historically, that actually was the situation. It was a very elite place. Now, this has repercussions. There's a statement from Rav Dessler that some people mamish find they can't believe it, but Rav Dessler said it. You have to be mepharish a little bit. Over the years, and I'm not here to be machria, because all the inyanim I'm telling you are shitas of different gedolim, so obviously I'm not machria, who's right and who's wrong, and it's not for us to be machria, but just to be aware, that people said, you know, maybe it's not right that we have yeshivas where, you know, the shiurim are striving to do things bi'iyun with all the rishonim, all the achronim. A lot of people don't get it. A lot of people don't really understand it. Wouldn't it be better for us to have yeshivas that are geared to more tzmikias, more superficial learning, where more people pick up more knowledge? And that way, more people may walk away from yeshiva with more yedios than under the standard yeshiva program. So Rav Dessler said, and Chazanish said a similar thing, well, what's going to happen is that maybe more people will walk away knowing more, but you're not going to produce the gadol that you would produce. So someone else says, so what? But I mean, the way it is now, let's assume, that, although this is an exaggeration, you have a system that produces the one gadol out of a thousand, and the other 999 might be shvach, as opposed to a more superficial yeshiva where you might have 1,000 people who are, you know, starker in yedias entire. So Rav Dessler is said to have remarked, it is kedai to have 999 korbanos, in other words, to produce one gadol, instead of having everybody okay, but not creating the atmosphere, the sviva, for that one gadol. And he says, it's like the concept is, even if everyone else goes to pots, if you can create, I mean, Lamaisa, he's painting a picture that's more pessimistic than is the case. I mean, but he says, by Guzma, even if you'd have a situation where you'd have, everybody would fail, but if this would produce the one gadol, Jean Rav Dessler touched up that the goal of the yeshiva is to produce the gadol b'tayra, even if the pshat is other people would benefit from a different type of chinuch. And rather than compromise the type of chinuch that will produce the gadol, he says it's better to have a korban on the other people. Now, this is a controversial statement. And I'm not sure if everybody would agree. But he tines that you see that the hashpah of a gadol on Am Yisrael can be infinite. The Vilna Gaon, of course, Gadol Shebe Gedolim, was not somebody who was involved in big numbers. The Vilna Gaon did not... teach on a lower level. The Vilna Gaon taught only Gedolim themselves, and he was Mitzamtzum himself. He could have had many, many more Talmidim in a different way. But you see that from his concentration on those who became Gedolei Torah, like all the yeshivas exist, all the yeshivas come from Volozhin, basically. So the idea that the yeshivas were elitist institutions, in a way, even continues when yeshivas are now open to everybody. That in many ways, the whole Derech HaLimud that we have is not necessarily going to always be the best limud for each yachid. Now, having said that, it's still shayach to be mechalek between how a yeshiva is set up and what we do for individual yechidim. In other words, even if yeshiva as it's set up must be geared to the kind of advanced learning that might only be best for a real mitzuyan, that doesn't mean every yachid has to be condemned to walk lockstep in that particular way. It's still shayach to make individual hachanas for yechidim who need a different type of chinuch, but you don't change, this is the Chayyav of Dessler's point, you don't change the tzuras ha-yeshiva. The tzuras ha-yeshiva remains a certain thing. Again, to give you another analogy, it was just an analogy, college was the same issue. You know, in the United States, Eretz Yisrael already, it's not a machlokes anymore, but in the United States, there was, and to some degree is, although Neri Yisrael is the only holdout, my yeshiva is the only holdout on this, but there was a big machlokas, you know, should the yeshiva allow Bachrim to go to university? Now, now, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, most of the great yeshivas in America did allow their students to have a night college program. I'm talking about Mir, Torah Vadas, Chaim Berlin, Neri Yisrael, of course, there still has, in Baltimore. And even though, you know, any Rosh Yeshiva would say, L'chatchila, we'd like you to learn all day, that would be L'chatchila. But they said, listen, if a guy's in America and a guy's got to prepare for Parnassa, better to have him have a Makom Torah where he can learn two Siddurim, even if he's going at night to college. Now, that was the shita of many in the United States. We know that Rav Aaron Kuppler in Lakewood was a very big misnaget to that idea. What then happened, it's not entirely clear historically why that happens, but what then happened was there was a shift to the right. Again, I'm not using right and left in derogatory terms, I'm just there was a shift to the right, and Mir, Torah Vadas, and Chaim Berlin, they discontinued college programs. Neri Yisrael in Baltimore still has a college program, which is why Neri Yisrael is a little controversial among yeshivas. The Stipler, of course, was always misnaget to Neri Yisrael. In fact, there's an interesting story. He was a good, Rav Stipler was a close friend of Rav Ruderman Zatzal, my Rosh Hashiva, Rosh Hashiva of Neri Yisrael. And in fact, in the first editions of the Kilas Yaakov, they were dedicated to Hagain Rav Yaakov Yitzhak Ruderman because he also raised money for him and the like. But in the later editions, Rav Ruderman's name was taken out. Now, you know, these are always rumors, you can't be medayak, but the Velt says that the reason why Rav Ruderman's name was taken out is that the Stipler was misnaget to the Hashkafa that allowed guys in yeshiva to go to college. He felt it was a taruvas of kaidish and chayil, and a yeshiva has to be a makam of kulo Torah without having a taruvas. The other thing that he was upset about is that in Baltimore in particular, one of the colleges that guys go to is Loyola University. Loyola University, all Loyola schools are Jesuit schools. That means they're Catholic schools. And there's a getchka, there's a shesi v'yarev, there's a cross on each classroom wall. So they asked the shayla of the Roshiva Maturit. He says it's not a church, they're not praying there, etc. Just like a hospital room sometimes has it, you can't always do anything about it. So the Stipler says was very incensed about that, also befret. So mainly he took off the name. But the point I want to make, I don't want to digress too far with this, but the point I want to make is this. So you did have a machlekes in Shita, but here's the point I want to say, that even Rav Aaron, who is the big, big kanoi about a yeshiva not having any official connection with a college, if sometimes there were yechidim, individuals, either they were Chosrei B'tshuva, Bali Tshuva, who needed to do things, or even not Bali Tshuva, just people who needed secular education, Rav Aaron would say, you could vadai learn in the yeshiva, we will not accept you officially as a member of the yeshiva, etc., but we'll try to create a makom for you. In other words, the point I'm making is that on one hand, there's a concept of a tzuras ha-yeshiva, but on the other hand, there are cheshbainas that you have to make with yechidim to give them what they need. This is the same thing with Rav Dessler's point. Dessler's point is you're not Mishana, the Derech Halimut of Yeshiva, but for Yechidim, one is willing. Just like Baruch Hashem, I have to say that Or Sameach tries to do that little commercial. Or Sameach tries to do that as well. You know, we have guys who hang around. They're really part of Or Sameach, but they hang around in Mir, or they hang around here, or there, or they learn something else in afternoon Seder, etc. And this is actually a strength. One might say, hey, that's not right. You know, you have a yeshiva, you gotta do what the yeshiva does. But no, it's a strength that one is makir. On one hand, a yeshiva is a makam for a tzibur to do certain things in a certain way. But we also understand that for yechidim, you have to be willing and to make what's necessary. So it's not necessarily a contradiction. Now, obviously, it's a little difficult. At some point, it's going to overlap. I mean, if you make a separate seder for 350 guys, everybody's doing a totally separate thing. At some point, you don't have a yeshiva anymore. Everyone's doing their own thing. But if it's a yetzei min haklal, these things are appropriate. Yeah.
Would you say it's different nowadays? Because nowadays, there's people who can't learn a whole day, half a day. So you have, not just one person, but groups of people, just half a day is the most they can learn.
Again, I walk on thin ice because I don't want to.
These people go off to derech.
I understand. So it's a strong shikol. It's a strong argument that gedolim have to be machriya. Again, Rav Dessler's position was a yeshiva has to be a place of full time learning, because if you create half time institutions, then even people who might have been gedolim might come there and they'll just become balabatim. And therefore, he says, if your full-time institution is going to hurt 999 people, he says, it's still kedai as a korban to produce a gadol hador. That's one approach.
Would he have said that nowadays as well?
Well, apparently, if he said that it's kedai to lose 999, then I think he would have said it nowadays. Now, not everybody would say that. Some people say, I mean, my Rosh Hashiva's shikl seem to have been that the more yidden you can get to learn Torah, the better, and therefore one shouldn't be so makbid on that particular tzura. Now, I want to point out that that itself goes back much earlier, but it goes back to the shaila of closing velazhin. If you remember, there's really two shitas why velazhin was closed down. It was closed down, and it was closed down voluntarily. In other words, the Russian government didn't close it down. The Velt shita, the standard understanding of why Volozhin was closed down, was because since the Russian government demanded that they introduce Limudei Chol, it was the decision of the Netziv and Rav Chaim was the junior Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, that it is better not to have a yeshiva than to have a yeshiva that introduces secular studies as part of the Limud, because if you do that, you're compromising the chashivas of Torah. And even if you have a yeshiva that limps along with that compromise, ultimately Torah is not going to be served in its greatest way. And even if that meant the yeshiva will close down, because the Netziv's cheshbon was, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will somehow ensure that Torah will remain in Klal Yisrael. The Kachave, indeed, that in the aftermath of Volozhin, all the great other yeshivas opened up. Mir, Slobodka, Telz, Panovich, we'll talk about them, but they all opened up. And the mashal that they gave was, it's like a well or a spring. A spring is gushing water. If you block a spring totally, its force is undiminished. And if its force is undiminished, it'll come out b'kayach somewhere else. Masha'en came, if you make a little hole where some of the water can come out, so good, you have some of the water, but it no longer has that koach or force to come out elsewhere. So it's a nice mashal. So the Nesiv's mashal was that he was misnabin. Now remember, he died before all of these yeshivas started. He died just 18 months after Volozhin was closed. He died of heartbreak. It was mamish a korban. But he said it would be like a mayan, that if you block the mayan, its kayach will come out elsewhere. But if we would have had Limud Echol, we would have had like a million, like YU yeshivas or Volozhin yeshivas, you know, with secular studies and the like. Now, this is an Eidus. I want to go back a little bit. Although I say the Velt said it, and I was a little critical of it, I suggest that it maybe was a made-up Vort. But in fact, what I actually saw was, I actually saw that this is the Eidus, this was the Eidus of Rav Chaim Berlin, who is interesting. Let me tell you a little bit about the Nitziv's family. The Nitziv, I think he had more sons, but he had two sons that are well known in the world of Torah. His oldest son was Rav Chaim Berlin, after whom the yeshiva in New York is named. And Rav Chaim Berlin had an interesting career. Rav Chaim Berlin was a big, big bucky in Shas and Paiskim, and he was a Rav of Moscow. Big Rav in Moscow, and then he was in business, etc. This is in the 19th century. And at some point, the Nitziv wanted to bring him in to be Rosh Yeshiva. The Nitziv himself wanted to come to Eretz Israel and retire, so to speak, or whatever he would do in Eretz Israel, and he wanted Rav Chaim Berlin to be Rosh Yeshiva. That itself created a huge machlokes, because Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the famous Rav Chaim, had been junior Rosh Yeshiva of Elazhin for a number of years, and the Nitziv's proposal was that Rav Chaim Berlin will become head Rosh Yeshiva and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik will still remain junior Rosh Yeshiva. And the truth is, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was probably more popular in the yeshiva than even the Nitziv. You had a choice of what shir to go to. In Volozhin, nobody put you in a shir. You went to the shir you wanted. And Rav Chaim's derech, you can understand, was more captivating. The Nitziv's derech, the Nitziv was a moridika baki. The Nitziv was a baki b'chol ha-tayrekula. But it was more of a methodical pshat derech. And Rav Chaim had, you know, the beautiful, deep Rav Chaim's. So the minds of Volozhin all flocked to Rav Chaim. So they figured when the Nitziv retires, Rav Chaim will become head Rosh Yeshiva. Well, Nisnavu v'lo yadu ma Nisnavu. Yes, it was beshert that Rav Chaim would become Rosh Yeshiva, but not Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, but Rav Chaim Berlin. So they brought in Rav Chaim. Now the problem is, Rav Chaim Berlin's derech was very much like his father. And also, Rav Chaim had been in Rabbanus and in business. He had not been in the yeshiva world, so his Torah was not yeshivish Torah. So because the Volozhiner B'nai Torah were very independent, they rioted, whatever it is. They stopped going, they went on strike. It's amazing how many times you read they went on strike. I mean, they just did things. And there was even a Shemua, although this is probably Motzi Shemra, so I really shouldn't say it. There was even a Shemua that the real reason the Nitziv closed down Volozhin is because the yeshiva did not accept Rav Chaim Berlin as Rosh Yeshiva, because only 2 years afterwards it closed down. Now, I say, this is probably Maitzi Shemra, and it was probably spread by the Maskilim, because you can imagine that the whole impetus for secular studies in Volozhin was because of the Maskilim, and the Maskilim were gaining, but when the Jews see that Volozhin closed down because of the Maskilim, in a sense, you can imagine that it made the Maskilim look very bad. He says, look what you did! You caused the Khorban of the greatest yeshiva in the world. Right, in a way, it was kind of an attack on Haskalah. So because of this, the Maskilim made up the idea that, you know, hey, Volozhin closed down because the Nitziv was jealous that they weren't Makabel, his son. But this was in the Yiddish papers and other things, this idea. But be it as it may, Rav Chaim Berlin himself, the Nitziv was not zeicher to go to Eretz Yisrael because the Nitziv got sick shortly thereafter and died in Warsaw. But Rav Chaim Berlin did come to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Chaim Berlin, and in fact he was like the assistant of Rav Shmuel Salant. He was the Rav of Yerushalayim. Rav Chaim Berlin was the assistant Rav, and Rav Chaim Berlin also had one of the largest private svarim collections in the world, and I don't know where it is now, but it was brought to Yerushalayim, and it I don't know if it's in one place now or in a lot of places, but it was a very meforsome collection of svarim. So Rav Chaim Berlin is mayit that his father told him. Rav Chaim Berlin testifies, and he says his father told him the day before the Nitziv died, the day before the Nitziv was nifter, that my son, remember not to be machnes limudei chayo into a yeshiva. And that's where he gave him the mashal, Rav Chaim Berlin reports, of the Mayan, the spring that is blocked, that will come out with greater force. So what the Velt says does have a good edus. The edus is Rav Chaim Berlin. Leidach Gisa, on the other side of it though, I do want to tell you the account of the Torah Tamima, who was the Nitziv's nephew, And in truth, the Nitziv's nephew, again, you're going to, well, Nitziv's nephew versus Nitziv's son, isn't Nitziv's son closer? You know, it's we don't always know, because the truth is, the Nitziv's nephew was with his father, I'm sorry, with his uncle, more prolonged day after day after day than Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim Berlin was much older. Rav Chaim Berlin was in Moscow, was in different places. He was not with his father on a day-to-day as much as Rav Baruch Epstein, who was much younger. Baruch Epstein was only 14. Or 15 at the time, but the Torah Tamima, I mean, he doesn't bring it as a machlokas. He doesn't say Rav Chaim Berlin says this, but he just, in the narrative of what happens, he says, you know, my uncle was not against Limud Echol in the yeshiva. My uncle, in fact, thought Limud Echol was fine, but the problem was that the Russian government wanted to supervise, and Anat Kedei Kach, by the way, that the proposal of the Russian government, imagine this is, I mean, imagine if you were the Nitziv, what you would do was they'll have Limud Echol from 9 to 3, and then they'll have 2 hours of Gemara. It's totally different. It's not like, oh, we'll have 2 hours of Limud Echol. I mean, the Russian proposal was 9 to 3 have secular courses. So the Torah Tamima says, I mean, that was the problem. The problem was not a little Limud Echol. The problem was you were like destroying the whole Seder. So apparently there is a big machlokas, and this is a machlokas that we still have now with Toro, with YU, even with Neri Yisrael, where the college is not on the yeshiva, but guys go to college, right? This is and the yeshiva gives them credits. You know, so these are machloksim about the concept of Tzuras HaYeshiva, and generally the concept that one has to debate is there like a tzura of a yeshiva that you have to have, or is it the concept that you create different types of mostos for different types of people, understanding that each yochid needs a different hanhaga. Yeah, I'll get to you in a second. Again, apropos of just digression, because one maisa reminds me of another maisa. This idea that there's a chiluk between the tzibor and the yochid. I'll tell you a beautiful story, which is not really nogeya this, but it shows you how a Rosh Hashiva has to be sensitive, that yechidim have different needs. There was a maisa with the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim once had to kick a bacher out of Raden, not because the bacher was learning Shvach. The bacher was Mechal Shabbos. It's Mechal Shabbos. So the Chafetz Chaim says, you got to leave. Can't be in yeshiva anymore. So the bacher starts walking away. So the Chafetz Chaim says, where are you going? The bacher says, well, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rebbe, actually the Chafetz Chaim was not the Rosh Yeshiva, but the Rebbe kicked me out. So the Chafetz Chaim says, I kicked you out of yeshiva because, you know, you might be a bad hashpa on other people, but I'm not going to abandon you. You'll learn with me and stay in my house. Now, I'm not sure if for this guy it was such a good deal. Having the Chafetz Chaim as a chavrusa is not the easiest type of thing to do. The story is the bacher stayed in the Chafetz Chaim's house, and the Chafetz Chaim learned with him. Because the Chafetz Chaim said, just because you can't be in the yeshiva doesn't mean you're a garnish, and it doesn't mean I throw you away. I have to care about you, but I have to care about you in a way that is not a negative. That's a beautiful story, because sometimes we think, oh, you kick a guy out, so forget it. You know, you're on your own. Chafetz Chaim says it's two different things. What's good for the yeshiva is one cheshbon I have to make, and then I have to make another cheshbon. How do I help you? And my chiyuv to help you is not compromised by the decisions I have to make for the yeshiva. It's a very, very beautiful story, because it shows you that the yachid is never ignored, or shouldn't, well, no, I shouldn't say never ignored, he is ignored, but the mahalach is, the yachid should not be ignored, even when he does not necessarily fit into the college one.
Yeah, so how come the yeshiva Chaim Berlin today allows English if the Nitziv clearly instructed him not?
Yeah, that's a very good kasha, especially if it's the, well, first of all, today they don't. Today they did.
They let you night class.
Oh, they have, no, I believe, unless they change, I believe they don't. Do you know that they still do? But whatever, but you are correct. In the 60s and 70s, when I was in Neri Yisrael, Chaim Berlin did allow it. Of course, everyone has high school, but that's another question. I mean, in America, every yeshiva has, well, not every, but most yeshivas have secular high school. Why did they allow it? That's a good question. If the idea would be America is different, I'm not sure the Nitziv would agree with that. But, you know, the way it worked is a lot of things are, you know, you go where the money is. If the money was given to establish a certain yeshiva a certain way, then in America at least, that's how it worked. Eretz Yisrael, to Eretz Yisrael's credit, in Eretz Yisrael, money plays less of a difference. Meaning, the Brisker Rav and others said, we will not accept money from people who make improper demands, even if that means we don't have money. Which is why yeshivas don't have money. They basically don't accept. In America, money has a certain influence in how decisions are made. And they have influence here too, but at least there are other segments that try to be Al-Tairus HaKadosh. So this issue is a big issue, and again, I'm not here to be machria, but if you ever have to establish yeshivas, you see what the problem is. The problem basically is, do you kind of say a yeshiva has to be a certain standard, and we will make it that standard no matter what? Or do you say, our goal is to be Marbitz Torah to as many people as possible, and if that means we have to have different types of shinoyim, it's still kedai, because that way we reach more people. Machlekes, once again, a machlekes, how to understand the taich of the closing of the Volozhiner yeshiva. But be it as it may, whether we take Rav Chaim Berlin's story, or whether we take the Torah Tamima's story in the Sefer Makor Baruch, it is very true that the closing of Volozhin did create an explosion of smaller Mostos HaTaira that were created throughout Lithuania in particular. Maybe I'm biased, but the Gedolim of Slobodka say that Slobodka became the successor of Volozhin in that way, as the Eim HaYeshivas. Again, the Talmud of Mir might say differently, but it is, Slobodka became that. Yeah.
Is it not true that also before there were no yeshivas, right?
Right. People, there were local based medrashes.
First
right.
organized yeshiva, which
right.
the purpose for that was because they wanted to provide something like you said for the
yes.
elite.
Right.
Right. So nowadays it is a little bit different in the sense that if it weren't for yeshivas, people wouldn't be learning Kimat Bichlal. It's not like a kid at 18 years old is going to be sitting in the basement. The world's a little bit different. So is it possible that, not that just say, oh, times change, it's different and the shita should be different, but also that, a lot of the type of yeshivas for these type of guys are not going to attract somebody who's going to be a Gadol B'Yisrael anyways. And you have guys who, if they don't go to this yeshiva, they're not going to go anywhere. So it's not attracting the Gadol. So maybe we could just not call it a yeshiva, or we just call it something else.
So that actually is proposed, although you could argue, who cares what things are called, but you're actually right.
Is it just
this concept of semantics plays a certain role, because there are Gadolim that say, Yuvarai should have Mostos that either give, part-time learning combined with secular studies or vocational training, job training, or even recreational. Sometimes you have kids at risk. We call them kids drugs or whatever it is. So half of the day, or maybe even less than half of the day, they might learn some Torah. The rest of the time, they play basketball or something. And Gedolim have said, we need such mostos, but maybe don't use the word yeshiva. Don't dilute it. Call it a mosad. Call it. So you might say, well, names are names, but no, they say no. Yeshivas should have a certain definition. And then you have other things for people that are given what they need. And also, I think you're right that, since Volozhin was really kind of the first, at least in hundreds of years, so it was needed to establish the definition of full-time learning. Once the idea is rooted that there's such a thing, and Baruch Hashem, I think today, it's understood, then already it's shayach to create alternatives, because the potential gedolim already have a makom that they know that they can gravitate to. Then, which is the very beginning, it's like they say, when you're makalkal something at the very beginning, it's much worse. It's like the analogy that Rav Dessler gives is, when you build a bridge, and often when you build a bridge, you start from one end, and then another end. And if you're like 1 inch off at the beginning, just 1 inch off, by the time the two ends are supposed to meet in the middle, you're already miles apart. Because the sheirish was nifgam, the beginning was nifgam. If the beginning has a pagam, then that affects everything very drastically. That's why the chatam of the avos could be so serious. Right? So what you're saying has a svara that maybe in the beginning of the hisyastus of the yeshiva, there has to be a certain akanos, al tairus hakodesh, that might be less significant. But, you know, you hear, I mean, I remember reading that, you know, these yeshiva New York based on Talmud. I don't know if you heard about it. It's in Brooklyn. It's a well-known yeshiva. It's not so large, but it has, at least historically, it had very, very chashuv of people. It was founded by the survivors of Mir, Shanghai Mir, of Leib Malin. Great Talmud and Chachamim. But they were very, very big kanoim. They said yeshiva has to be yeshiva. So the story goes that the Bokhrim once paid to have a soda machine installed in the yeshiva. So they say Rav Leib Laban, like, was not a strong guy. He like ripped the soda machine off the wall and like threw it off the building. He says a yeshiva is not a park, whatever it is. He was very mock with it, you know. You don't have soda machines, water coolers. He said that all of that was connected to Surah. Not even a public telephone. Now they have it. See, people come. This Katnu Adaris, but he would not allow a public telephone. Etc. There were no cell phones in those days anyway, but you know, so he had this idea, seriously, yeshiva, and then he kind of made a statement which, you know, historically is obviously not true. He says the tzura of yeshiva has not changed from the days of Ravina and Ravashi, and we can't be Mishan. Okay, I mean, okay, the mice, I mean, obviously, Volozhin, even Volozhin was not the yeshiva of Ravina and Ravashi. It wasn't the same way, but he was very, very machbid in the idea of a tzura. In fact, I'll tell you another maisa about Rav Leib Malin. It says, Talmidim from Torah Vadas came to get a feher from him to be accepted in Beis HaTalmud. So he talks and learning with them for 10 minutes. And he then looks at them, like for 5 minutes, doesn't say anything, and says, come back in 2 weeks. So they come back in 2 weeks. He talks with them and learning again for 10 minutes. And he looks at them, they don't say anything, he doesn't say anything, he says, come back in 2 weeks. So they come back a third time. And finally, once again, he says, come back in 2 weeks. So one of the guys finally like says in frustration, can the Rosh Yeshiva tell us if we're accepted or not accepted? I mean, we've been coming back, and apparently it was like a two-hour trip. So the Rosh Yeshiva says, of course, I accepted you the first time. But you didn't ask to get in. You didn't say, can we come in? And the Talmud can't be nichnas to yeshiva unless he's a mavakesh. He says, you didn't ask, so I'm not going to let you in until you ask. Again, he had certain shitas that there's a certain protocol, a certain derech eretz to Torah that you have to have. You have to like beg to come in, and then we'll let you in. But you know, until you ask, we don't give you. This is Rav Leib Malin's kashban and the like. Yeah.
What about the yachid who really needs, let's say, a vocational school or to go to college or to
something,
and he just gets dragged along the system?
All right, so here's the thing. So first of all, I was saying that even Rav Aaron in America was the big kanoi. He said you have to have full-time learning, nothing else. That was Lakewood. And Rav Aaron never mattered any type of college within to be a member of Lakewood and the like. But even Rav Aaron was sometimes meyayetz individuals.
So that's more of probably if someone came to him privately. But just the normal regular kid who wouldn't think he's different than anybody else really is.
So this I would have to say is a machlokas. In other words, there are many gedolim, Rashi Yeshivas, Mashkichim, Bali Musar, who will be miyayetz individuals, that for your individual growth, it is an atzlacha in life, it is better for you to have a parnasa, it is better for you to even go to college.
And sometimes go over to them and tell them?
Sometimes they will. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, that tends to be less shechiach. In Eretz Yisrael, of course, there are reasons for that too, because if once you're out of yeshiva, you know, you're in the army. there are reasons for that. But again, it's a very delicate machlokas. There are some that say that if you start giving out that message, there'll be too many people that'll want to jump on that train, and then you might be losing the gedolim of Talmidei Chachamim, and you weaken the whole yeshiva, and therefore it's kedai to let some people suffer to produce the gadol. That's one cheshbon. There are others that say no, we have to be matzil people in the best way that is for them. If you're asking me, I'm naita personally to the second derech, but again, it's not for me to be machria. I think that the Kabbalah I have for my Rosh Hashiva was to chanoch lenar al pidarko, to identify the individual derech that is best for an individual Talmud. But as I say, not all agree to that. Yeah.
And why did they have English in the high schools?
so why don't they have English in high schools? Well, the short answer is that in the United States, it is required by law to have high school education. Yeshivas are not allowed to operate without limudei chol. It's against the law. On the other hand, I have to say that there are most of us in the United States, Hasidic schools in particular, that don't have English. So they're breaking the law, but nobody notices. But at least those that have high school programs, it's because of the law. Now, I think I mentioned Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky once remarked, because this is the shaila. The shaila is, if you're telling a high school kid, you know, really, you shouldn't have high school, but we have high school because it's the law. So what should the kid's approach be to Limud Echol? Should he cut class to learn, etc.? Should he just try to get by? So Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky tells his bachurim in Philadelphia that if you have to take something, says you're mechuyev to be good at it. You're mechuyev to work and try to be mashlim. Because even if something is not the l'chatchila dekederech that you should have taken, once you're put in that matzav, you have to know that it's hashkacha that says you can use this in a good way. So if you learn how to write well, you learn how to speak well, etc., that will help you in Harbatzas Torah and Kiddush Hashem. Even if we wouldn't tell you l'chatchila to pursue that derech. And a person should never say, well, if I'm in a situation I have to be in, I'll just do it a very, very b'di'evit. He says you have to make every b'di'evit a l'chatchila. So that was his judgment. Which is why Philadelphia, it is said, I don't know firsthand, it is said Philadelphia is a very good secular, even though it's a Lakewood yeshiva. It's a Lakewood yeshiva, and they have a very good secular high school. So, and Rav Yaakov, his father, said very much the same thing. But I think the issue is, though, I think the point that was made earlier, that once the concept of a full-time learning yeshiva is very well established, maybe there might be more flexibility in creating alternative mostos, because you're not going to divert the cream of the crop. Maybe that has a certain cheshbon. Yeah.
You said that apparently to some opinions that you can sacrifice X amount of pita.
Yeah.
Where's the makor for that? I mean, I don't understand.
The analogy is, there's an analogy. The analogy is
that people go up to derech and they basically end up.
Well, it's a controversial issue. Maybe Rav Dester spoke b'lashon guzma, a certain exaggeration, and may not have meant it literally. People should go off the derech, but this is his beautiful taich. It's an ingenious pshat. There's a Gemara that says, "Elef nichnasim lamikra." 1,000 people come in to learn chumash, v'yachad, and 1 out of 1,000, yaitzei lahayra, goes out to be the paisek of the door. So Rav Dessler learns that to get the Echad Yaitzei Lahaira, it's kedai even if 1,000 people are not getting the type of Torah learning that would be best for them.
You
could understand it the other way. It just means that 1,000 people, that's their limit. 100% correct. In other words, to say that Rav Dessler has a raya from that Gemara, 100%, it's not a raya, but this is how he learned that Gemara. Yeah.
What would be a typical example of something like this?
Of what? Which point?
Like, the issue should have been changed, but isn't because of, tests? Like, what are we talking about?
Well, I'll give you an example. I don't want to weaken anybody's connection, but let's take a typical yeshiva shir. And maybe not in our Sameach, maybe not so much in our Sameach, because we deal with a different clientele. But you go to a typical yeshiva shir, starting even in high school. So the Rebbe comes along and speaks out, Rav Chaim and a Ketzayis and a Nesivis and a Tumim. And certainly a high school kid barely understands what's going on. You know, it really makes no sense to him. Even if he has a good memory, he can regurgitate, the Ketzayis says this. Well, but the truth of the matter is he doesn't read Rashi well, he doesn't really understand a Taisvis, Kasha, and a Teretz. But it's Makubal that, we try to learn at this high level. Now, the truth of the matter is, the average high school kid, I'll use high school as an example, is much better served, learn Mishnayos. Why are we even learning Gemara? Go back to Pirkei Avos where you have 5 years, learn Mishnayos, learn Chumash and Rashi. Because one of the real problems in the yeshiva world, and it is a real problem, is you can learn for many years. A person can learn for many years and doesn't know a lot. You don't know a lot. it's like, you know, sometimes it's embarrassing when you get married. You know, your wife asks you, or asks the Shaila on something. I don't know. You know, I didn't really learn that. Maybe she did. You know, maybe she did learn it. And the positive, well, you know, if we would learn more halacha, more Mishnayos, more Chumash, more Tanakh, we would walk out knowing something. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. As a matter of fact, again, I'm trying to keep myself out of this, so to speak. But the defenders of the system say that this type of system, for those who are mitsuyanim, will produce very deep thinkers and mechadshim and Rosh Yeshivas. So even though an average person would learn much more the other way, there's a sheet that we have to do it this way, because if we do it the other way, we'll produce a higher mediocre level, a higher median level. More people will be higher, but it'll be higher here instead of some people here and some people here. So Rav Dessler's cheshbon is better to have some people here and some people here than to have everybody here. That's the cheshbon.
An average person who knows this, could he say, like, I'll just take myself out of the system and just do my own thing because I know the secret?
I'm telling you secrets. Okay. I think yes. A good Rosh Yeshiva will try to devise a schedule for a yachid that will work without necessarily compromising the system. A system is in place, but then you understand that yechidim need deviation. But the big question is, which is still an unanswered question, is, well, okay, but L'chaira, what I'm suggesting is not only for Yechidim, what I'm suggesting is Rov. So what are you going to have? Rov, you have a system, and Rov people should be outside the system. It's a difficult thing. At that point, you know, you don't have a system anymore. So these are tzarechiyot. In other words, if you know, now you understand, being a Rosh Yeshiva is not an easy job. You think, oh, I want to learn all day, my whole life, so maybe I'll start a yeshiva. Well, no. If you want to learn all day, be a stockbroker or something. You know, the MS is a Rosh Yeshiva is one of the jobs where you have the least time to learn. Besides having to collect money, you know, Baruch Hashem, how much Rav Schiller is on the road and how hard he works. But really, every Rosh Yeshiva works so hard to collect money. But you also see the daigus and the achrayus of not trying to hurt what a yeshiva is, but at the same time understanding that each individual has to be reached as well. It's a tremendously, tremendous big achrayas. There's a beautiful, powerful word from Rav Aaron Cutler, who once said, this is an amazing thought, you know, Rav Aaron was the one that was mechadish the idea of Torah Lishma, full-time learning. It was like, in America, because there was Torah Vadas, there was YU, but there was always that combination. Rav Aaron was mechadish after the war, the idea of Torah Lishma. This really was his chiddush, and many people thought in America you can't have that. And in fact, he was even against it. How do you sell the notion of full-time learning to a culture that never had it? Very, very hard. You couldn't say our goal is to train rabbis, because Rav Aaron said, Lav Davka. He says, Lav Davka, we're not training rabbis. In fact, I'll tell you a story. My Rebbe, Rev Klefsky Zatzal, I don't know if you've heard of him, but a great, great Talmud Chacham and the Magid Shir of, you know, Ein Kamoh. But he actually was drafted in World War II. He was a Talmud of Rev Reuven Brzezovsky or Shlomo Hyman, and he was a big Mitzuyan. But he was drafted. How did he get drafted? I mean, you know, if you were in a yeshiva, you didn't get drafted. So he says the answer is because the board asks you a question: are you studying to be a rabbi? Now, I'm telling you, if you ever get asked that question, just say yes. He says, no, I'm not studying to be a rabbi. I'm studying because my life's mission is to learn Torah. It's not to be a rabbi. So they put down Batlan. Oh, guy's not doing anything. And they actually drafted him because he refused to say. Now, his parents went to court for him, and actually after 18 months, they got him freed. But he was in the U.S. Army for 18 months. Fortunately, he was stationed domestically. They didn't ship him abroad. And it said, I think it says he finished Ksuvus and Yavamas during that time. And he even got Rishus from the Army to go to Yeshiva every Shabbos on the condition that he wear his uniform So he would come. He would come, just like Sichayalim sometimes come in the uniform. He would come into the base medrash, you know, in U.S. Army uniform, and he would give a chabura. He was giving a chabura every Shabbos. He was a very kosher person, and the like. But it's an example that he felt Torah Lishma. You don't say, I'm learning to be a rabbi. I'm not learning to be a rabbi, etc. So Rav Aaron had a lot of difficulty selling this idea. Like, nobody was makabel. Balabata, we're not makabel this day. So Rav Aaron spent a lot of his time fundraising. He was already a gadol in Europe, but he was fundraising. And what was he getting? You know, $5 here, $10 here. So one time he went to Miami to collect money. And he goes to a hotel to go to a gevir, and he got almost nothing. And when he's in an elevator, a woman goes on the elevator dressed as they dress in Miami. And this already broke Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron took all sorts of bizyonos and all sorts of insults, but he started sobbing a little bit. He started crying. He was really tzabrachah that he had to go through such a humiliation and such sar. But he said the following vort. He says, you know why Rosh Hashivas have to go around collecting money? The Torah says, when you kill somebody b'shegeg, when you kill someone by accident, there's a punishment called golus. So he says, every Rosh Hashiva is potentially a hayreg nefesh. The decisions Rosh Hashiva made may destroy a person's neshama, could destroy a person. Either you kick him out, or you give him a derech that's not right for him, and he becomes rachuk min haTorah. Now granted, the Rosh Hashiva is doing it b'shegeg, but even a Reitzeach B'Shaygeg is Mechuyiv to go into Golas. So he says, it's Nigzar and Rosh Yeshiva to go into Golas because they're Reitzchim B'Shaygeg. Tremendous idea that this is the Achrayas of a Rebbe, of a Rosh Yeshiva, not to be a Reitzeach B'Shaygeg. So, you know, you're right. That's a very, very difficult issue. In fact, the Chazon Ish said it in a different context. The Chazon Ish said, in order to decide whether a person should be expelled from a yeshiva, you have to have a Beis Din of Chaf Gimel, because that's Dinei Nefashis, that's deciding, right? You can't just make a simple decision. It's a question of a neshama at stake. So it's very, very hard. I mean, the issues that you're raising about how do you advise the yachid, what's right for the yachid. And one of the great signs of a real Marbitz Torah is a Marbitz Torah does not feel he owns Talmidim. That sometimes the Marbitz Torah should be willing to tell somebody, you would be better off somewhere else, not by me, not, right? Because if a person like wants to own people, but you know, you have to be by me, that can sometimes be very destructive for a person, right? So it's not easy to be a Rosh Hashiva. Yeah,
it could be good in Poshas to accept them as well.
You're right. No, you're right. You're right. So that's what the Chazon Ish was saying, in both sides. Because otherwise, you could just be Megal. I'll accept everybody. You know, in both sides, it's dinei nefashis. Although I heard an interesting shita, that a Rosh Yeshiva had a shita, he was very makbid who he accepted, because he was very makbid who he kicked out. In other words, he basically said, once I accept a bachur, I have achrayas for him, and then I'm kind of stuck with him, even if he's not so good. But until I accept him, I kind of don't know. It's like once you adopt a child, you know, you don't give the kid back. You know, you're kind of, although some parents do, by the way. So he felt that he had the right to be very, very selective in the admission process. Because once he took someone on, he had took full responsibility and would work with him, no matter what it became. So they're mechalik in that particular way. So if Bezer Sashet, you guys start mostos of any type, be aware of the tremendous, tremendous achrayas. I think they say at the establishment of the Volozhiner Yeshiva in the early 1800s, they say that Rav Chaim Volozhiner's tears, as they dug a foundation, they were going to put the first brick, and the brick was put on like a whole pool of Rav Chaim Volozhiner's tears. I'm not sure if it's true or it's a legend, but they say that it was miyusad on his tefillas, that it should be a makom kadosh. And the hatzlacha of Volozhin came from the demos that Rav Chaim Volozhiner was mogged at the establishment of the yeshiva. You were saying? Yeah.
No, the Rav said before about the moshul with the spring.
Yeah.
I understand it, but why is it that if the yeshiva would have carried on, there would have been no other yeshivas?
Well, I don't want to say there wouldn't have been no other yeshivas. There probably would have been other yeshivas, but here is the issue. The issue is, Volozhin set the tone and surah of what a yeshiva meant. So if Volozhin would have said, okay, half the day we'll do limudei chol, then that would have been what a yeshiva is. So Slobodka would have done it, Mir would have done it, Karnovich would have done it, Tells would... Now, maybe not, but the Nassib's argument would be that Volozhin defines the Tzuras HaYeshiva, so you can't compromise on that. Because then every yeshiva is going to be Volozhin, because that's the way it was. Mashenkein, if Volozhin died, so to speak, with the concept of full-time learning, that became the getter of what a yeshiva is, and everything else is a deviation from the getter, right? So
why didn't they have problems as well? I mean, Mir is also in the same area, is also in Belarus. So saying, why wouldn't that have problems with the Russian government as well?
You're asking why didn't it repeat itself? You're asking historically why wasn't it the same Shiley? Yeah. That's a very good point. We'll go over this. A part of it is the following. Part of it is just the accident of the shift, the constantly shifting Russian-Polish border. You have to understand, and we'll talk about it a little bit. The history is extremely complicated. We talk about Poland, Lithuania, Russia. I mean, there were other countries in Europe too, but the yeshiva world was fundamentally Poland, Lithuania, Russia. But the point is, there were strips of lands that were constantly going back and forth. Lithuania didn't exist as a country for many, many years. It was part of Russia, right, etc., or Soviet Union later. So basically what happened was, Volozhin was like stuck in the middle of Tsarist Russia, but then you had Slobodka was over into Poland, etc., going back to Lithuania, was independent at various years. Volozhin was not in Lithuania, by the way. See, we like to think Volozhin is the mother of Litvish yeshivas, but Volozhin wasn't in Lita. Actually, Volozhin was in Belarus. You know, so part of it is simply that. Part of it also is the Russian Revolution. Of course, the Russian Revolution created other tsarists, but the Tsar was overthrown, and some of those gezeros weren't there. So you're right, but it happened to be that the yeshivas were located out of the locale, which Mir was most of the time Mir was in Poland. Most of the time, Mir was not in Lithuania. The reason why we call it... So why do we call it Litvisha at all? I mean, it wasn't Litvisha. Because you have to understand, Lita is an imaginary country. Lita is what was the Lithuanian kingdom in the Middle Ages. And that became known to Jews as Lita, whether it was Russia, Poland, or Lithuania. Lita does not correspond to Lithuania, so to speak. And therefore, most of the Litvish yeshivas were not in Lithuania. They were in eastern Poland, which in the Middle Ages was part of the much larger kingdom of Lithuania. Okay, so you have to... The map is very confusing. In fact, they say, this is a joke, but they say that there was once a border dispute between Poland and Lithuania, and they didn't know how to be machria, the border dispute. So somebody came up with the idea, well, let's see how the Yidden there eat gefilte fish, because Polish gefilte fish is sweet, and Litvisha gefilte fish is peppery. So we'll see. If Yidden eat pepper gefilte fish, it's Lita, and if they eat sweet gefilte fish, it's Poland. So they were. So the story goes they were Machria, if it's Lita or Poland, by looking at it. What if it was, you go bus or Rave, Rave gefilte fish eaters, how do they eat the gefilte fish? Yeah.
And what
about
the Hasidim
just talking? Okay, so Hasidim, yeah, well, we'll talk about that. The area known as Lita, which whether it's Russia or Poland or Lithuania, was by and large the refuge of the Misnagdim, the Talmidim of the Gra. The one big exception was, of course, Lubavitch, Chabad. Chabad is a Litvish Hasidus, geographically. But the bulk of the Hasidic world was in Poland, but not the Litvish Poland, in further west. Further west. We'll get a map. I'll try to get a map. We should do PowerPoint. I don't know. To go over this. Particularly Galicia. Galicia is southern Poland, bordering with Austria. And they did not have that many yeshivas at the time. They had base medrash. People were learning, of course. They didn't have the organized yeshivas, but Hasidus was growing in Poland in great leaps and bounds.
It was growing, but it comes up happening and stuff. They didn't have yeshivas.
They did not start. They did not start. They started yeshivas eventually. They did with our Hasidish yeshivas today, of course. But in most of the 19th century, in the 1800s, they did not start yeshivas. They were basically, for example, Tomchei Tamimim, which is a great Lubavitcher yeshiva in Warsaw, Tomchei Tamimim, only started, I think, in the 1920s, and was because that the Rebbe Rashab of Shalom Ber thought that you needed to have yeshiva. you should copy the Litvisha on that, those things. But the concept of a yeshiva for Hasidim came late. It was much later than the Litvisha yeshivas. So now, Hungary had yeshivas. The Chasam Sofer had a very big yeshiva. So it's interesting. You have to be Mayan. That why do we consider Volozhin to be the Ema Yeshivas when Pressburg had a yeshiva that's almost as old? The Pressburg yeshiva goes back also to the early 1800s, and there were hundreds and hundreds of Talmidim. It's hard to be Magdir exactly. Well, what is the difference between Pressburg and Volozhin in the sense of a yeshiva? The Chasam Sofer had a yeshiva of hundreds and hundreds of Talmidim, but okay, maybe we'll look into this. So this is just a little bit, again, understanding the idea of the yeshivas and the like. I'll tell you that, okay, maybe we'll be mamshich later, but Slobodka became like the dominant, well, I get it, it's a bias because my rebbeim was from Slobodka, but it became like the dominant yeshiva in the area. But many of the Russian yeshivas of Mir and the like were Talmidim of Slobodka. A very good example is Rav Lezer Yehuda Finkel, Lezer Yudel, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, who came over to Eretz Israel after World War II and established Mir here. Who was his father? His father was Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, the same name as the present Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, and that Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel is the altar of Slobodka. Right? So the altar of Slobodka's son was the great Rosh Yeshiva of Mir. Rav Yerucham, who is the great Mashgiach of Mir, the great Bal Musar of Mir, was a Talmud of the altar of Slobodka. My Rosh Yeshiva says he remembers that even after Rav Yerucham was Mashgiach of Mir, really the greatest Mashgiach in Europe, he would come and visit the altar for Hadracha. And my Rosh Yeshiva as a Bacher remembers that the altar would be screaming at him. The altar has such an interesting personality, we'll devote a session to it. And he would say, "You're turning your Talmidim into boors, Amaratzim," whatever, the altar had a... And my Rosh Hashiva used to say, if he would ever speak to a Bacher the way the Altar of Slobodka spoke to Rav Yerucham, he says he would lose his yeshiva in a day. He says every single guy would leave. And yet Rav Yerucham was Makabel, the Musar. You know, he was already a Gadol, and already, and he was Makabel the Musar from the Altar of Slobodka like a young Talmud. You know, so it was very, very interesting. Okay, we still have to talk a little bit, obviously, about Zionism. Remember, we're trying to just to locate where we're going, because we go in different directions here. We're discussing essentially the different movements that befell Am Yisrael, particularly during the 1800s, some of them Altsad HaTov and some of them Altsad HaRa, Reform, Haskalah, the establishment of yeshivas by the Talmidei HaGra, and we're also going to talk about Zionism, which is a 19th century creation, Musar movements, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Hasidus, which is a little earlier, the 18th century, but it grew in the 19th century, and Rav Hirsch, Torah and Derech Eretz, right? So these are different winds that are blowing throughout the Jewish world at the time. Okay, have a good week.